So one of the lines in the Satipatthana Sutta, kind of the culmination of the refrain, has a sentence, has a phrase, not clinging to anything in the world. Not, the word clinging could also be grasping, if that works nicer for you. Not grasping at anything in the world. And it's such a powerful thing. I mean, to say nothing in the world, not clinging, not grasping. And you know, this thing about grasping, if you grasp something for a long time, you hurt yourself. If I'm holding the striker in my hand, bell striker, and if I just grip it really tight, and I'm not going to let go of this, this is worth clinging to. Everything, yeah, this Buddhism is right, you know, mostly it's okay, mostly you shouldn't cling to anything, but this is the thing. I can't let this go. I mean, this is the proof that I'm a good Dharma teacher. Every good Dharma teacher has a good bell striker. And this is, my whole existence depends on this bell striker, and this is like, I can't let this go. So I'm going to hold on for dear life. And so after a while, I'm hurting myself. After a while, my hand goes numb. Eventually, it might get paralyzed, and everything might grow so that, you know, my hand, so I can never open it again. You know, just... But to not grasp. Some people are afraid of not grasping or clinging because they lose what they have, they think. But there's one way to not grasp, not to cling, is to open the hand out flat and just hold the striker in the hand. Now, if what you're grasping is not a striker but a bird, finally it gets to fly away. The bird shouldn't live in your grasp of your hand. They should be free to fly. And if it's some kind of yucky liquid that oozes around, it might just slide right off and it's not needed anymore. Something very different can happen when the hand is open and flat. You can hold a lot of things, support things, and you could also release things, let things go, let things fall off, fall away. That can't happen if you're clinging. So to not cling to anything in the world doesn't necessarily mean we lose anything. It means that we're not gripping it. And sometimes, you know, it's hard to take the life out of the striker. But if we grip on too many things, we kind of kill it in certain kinds of ways. And with the hand open, if it needs support, it's there. If we need support, our hand is open to receive someone else's hand. If we want to show our friendliness and care for someone, you're not going to show it very well with the hand fisted up holding a striker. Come over here, let me show you how I care for you. And they just see a fist. But an open hand, the soft part of your hand, can, you know, touch them on the shoulder. And there can, you know, a lot more warmth can be exchanged. So this is all kind of a metaphor for letting go of the psychological clinging, mind's clinging that we have. And the mind is the same way. It can be opened up. And in this Satipatthana teaching, in these teachings that the Buddha gave about this mindfulness practice, he kept talking about mindfulness as something that brings safety, protection. I talked about that a few days ago. And protection helps us, feeling safe, feeling protected, makes it so much easier to begin relaxing, letting go of the grip. We can trust that we don't need to cling and hold on so much, so that it's okay to kind of begin to soften and begin maybe slowly, the process of opening, the journey of letting go. Rather than letting go being something you do all at once and forever, it's really a slow process, steadily, practicing steadily, slowly, on that journey, on that that path of maturation, of growing, that allows us to open the hand and allows things to begin to fall off, like the skin falls off the snake as it grows. So to be safe, to feel safe, does that. And how does this practice bring safety? There's another story about safety that the Buddha gave. He was giving a teaching and he said, once upon a time, there were these two acrobats. And the master acrobat and the apprentice. And the apprentice, for some reason, was called frying pan. Into the frying pan. Maybe it's a bit dangerous being an apprentice to an acrobat. Because they would climb up a bamboo pole and then do their acrobatics up there. And that was how they made their living. And so they were going to do their performance. And the master acrobat said to the apprentice, you watch over me, you protect me, and I'll protect you. And the word for rakati, which means protect, also means to observe. But I think here the meaning is, has maybe both meanings, but you watch over me. Like in English, you might say that. You watch over me, like protect me. And I'll watch over, and if you watch over me, you watch over me, and I'll watch over you, and that way we'll be safe. The apprentice says, no, you watch over yourself, and I'll watch over myself, and that way we'll be safe. So the Buddha tells that story, and then that's the end of the story. And so then he says, there's actually a method, there's actually reason, a good reason, or it's reasonable for the apprentice to say that. And the Buddha said that, I'll read you so that, no, I won't read you, it's so hard with my eyes these days, going back and forth. So he said something like, the Buddha said, by protecting oneself, one protects others. By protecting others, one protects oneself. And how does one protect oneself? By practicing four foundations of mindfulness. And thereby, you'll protect others too. And how do you protect others? By practicing the four foundations of mindfulness. And thereby, you'll be protected too. So this mutuality of protecting self can be a protecting of others, and protecting others can be a protecting of ourselves. In what way does that wonderful mutuality work? It works through this practice of, we're teaching this week, this practice of mindfulness, practice of awareness, establishing a clear awareness. And how does that work? How does that work? How are we safe? And that's kind of the question I asked 2 days ago, too. And one of the ways it works, it helps us not to cling. And if we don't cling, we don't harm. And in an amazing way, if we don't cling, we don't harm ourselves. And so this process of paying careful attention, waking up our awareness, and really starting to study ourselves in a deep, deep way so that we really see, understand the nature of our clinging, our grasping, our attachment in its big forms and its subtle forms. And learning that we are actually safer when we don't cling. But maybe safe in a particular way, and that is, whereas we become, with time, we become safe, protected from our own clinging, our own grasping, our own attachments. And one of the principles of Buddhism is that, you might not agree, but one of the principles is that all ways that we intentionally, deliberately harm other people involves clinging of some kind or other. So if we're free of clinging, we're protecting others from ourselves. That's how we protect others. We're protecting them from ourselves. And now others can harm us, for sure. But this is where it gets both fascinating and challenging, is that when others do something to us which is harmful, it can either go right through us, it can be a big ouch, and there's no clinging. Just ouch, that really hurts. But there's no clinging to it. Or it can come to us and there's a big ouch and we cling, we grasp, we resist. Our attachments get evoked and we get really attached to something. And the kind of a way of, there's a way in which that secondary arrow of clinging to the ouch, or clinging in response to the ouch, creates some of the deepest harm that we experience. And that's a, you know, I say that tenderly because there's this huge harm that's done to people do to each other, and maybe you've experienced from others. And I don't want to diminish that or kind of the difficulty of that. But even there, there's probably a role that your heart has in a completely understandable way, that you closed up, you tightened up, you got caught, there's clinging. And I've done that, and it wasn't until I became an adult that I was able to look back at what happened when I was growing up and recognize the times growing up where my heart just went cluck, you know, closed. And it happened, some of those times it happened that fast. Someone said something. Something happened. Sometimes it was kind of a deliberate choice. I'm not going to show that to anyone again. No way. And so then it stayed closed for years and years. And I didn't know it was closed. But as I started doing the practice, something began to thaw. Something, the safety of the practice, sitting quietly and relaxing and opening and seeing and being sensitive, I began to see the places that I had contributed being caught, being closed, being resistant. The ways in which then spilled over into the ways that I would blame others or get angry at them, or I'd be afraid because this place was closed or I didn't want to address it or have it touched anymore. So in this whole ecology of our hurt, our suffering, we have a role. We have some responsibility there. Say it differently, that's maybe the wrong word, but we have our contribution we've made. And the Dharma practice is most essentially about us learning to understand our contribution. Not necessarily, in a sense, not to dismiss the terrible things that happen, but that's where we can make the most difference. We might not be able to change other people, but we can change our hearts. It's possible. We can heal it. We can open it again. And so this is what we sit here to do. And then what I love about this acrobat story, this mutuality, to do this practice of mindfulness can be done motivated by helping us to find that inner safety in ourselves. And it can be simultaneously motivated by wanting to help to create safety for others. And what a beautiful way to live. What a beautiful motivation and dedication to live in this world, to help all of us, self and others, feel more at ease and comfortable and happy and unthreatened, and create the conditions so all of us, or the people we can meet, they have the opportunity to begin opening up what is closed in them. They have the opportunity to begin softening the grip, loosening the grip of whatever they're holding onto, because they start feeling safe and protected. So over and over again, we see the Buddha emphasizing somehow the connection between cultivation of this awareness and safety and protection and a refuge. So what I'd like to do is to take you through the Satipatthana Sutta, this discourse, in a different way than I did 2 days ago. 2 days ago, it was the four steps of the refrain. The overarching structure of the text is around these four different areas, particular areas that are useful to bring our attention to, because when we do, it helps develop, grow our capacity for clear awareness. The kind of clear awareness that can only be there when we start feeling a kind of safety and openness, a home and homeness, being at home in our ancestral lands, being home in our home in the best senses of the term, maybe cozy term. I like to interpret this text as being a journey and a process of unfolding. One of my favorite metaphors of this journey is that of a river, stream. If you're in the current of the stream, you can float, it carries you along. You just have to stay away from the bank so you don't get hooked on the branches hanging over the branch, over the river, but you can just float along. But there's all these ways that as we do this practice, something begins to shift and open and move and go along. And you can't help it if you create the conditions for it. It's like when my son, both sons, I think, when they were young, pretty young, five, maybe six, four years old, I used to gently put my hands on top of their head and say, "Will you stop growing? You're just perfect the way you are now. Can you just cut it out?" And they would laugh because they knew they weren't going to stop growing. And I kind of knew it. But the same thing with us. We'll keep growing. This Dharma practice, this awareness practice that we do, is a practice that takes the hand off the top of the head. So then we can grow. We don't block it. So there's a growth process here. This journey, this unfolding, this maturation. So I interpret the Satipatthana as these four different stages in this maturation. It is a certain kind of maturation process, a certain kind of growth and development that is from the outside in. It's a kind of coming home, coming inward into the kind of that kind of core, inward to some kind of the heart within us, something that's central. And so it begins by awareness of the body. I like to interpret it as being embodied, more and more embodied, living not with our body but through our body. It's so easy to be disconnected from the body and to be up in their thoughts and thinking about things in the control tower. And we have such an amazing network of nerves throughout the body that's ready and waiting for us to receive and take in and listen to its signals and the aliveness, the sensations, the awareness that's there in the body. And to do that and to relax. In this Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha talks about the instructions of feeling the body and relaxing it. And this is the beginning of also this process of safety, that we are nourished, we're nurtured by relaxation. If that relaxation helps us to feel safe and comfortable with ourselves and comfortable in our own skin in some way, And so we start there, at least in the text. You can start at other places, but in the text that's the way it goes. So from the outside. And then it goes to the vedana, which is the feeling tones of pleasant and unpleasant, neutral. And that is, it's kind of a, just talk about it, that pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. I don't know what it does for you, but I think in my mind, even as I still to this day, and even if I teach it now, I have this little feeling like suddenly we're flattening, dulling the world to pleasant and unpleasant. It's like kind of like two-dimensional or one-dimensional, or something's lost by that. But in experience, in ourselves, is actually the opposite. That to start tuning into the felt sense of the experience. And the pleasant and unpleasant is just shorthand for the richness of it, the ways in which it can be delicious and wondrous, and the ways it can be painful and hellish, a whole range of things. But to orient yourself around the simplicity of it, that it's either ouch or ah. And what I find most interesting about the second area of developing mindfulness, to start being aware of this, is I think of it as becoming aware of the quality of our inner being. Or say, I went a little ahead of myself. So when the Buddha teaches this, he actually teaches two different ways of experiencing these feeling tones. The ones that are more on the surface of our life, like for example, if we get sense pleasure, to have a nice, eat something very nice and tasty, or we have a nice sound we listen to, or a cozy something for our body. So then we're getting stimulated from the outside. Another way is this: the feeling tones, the quality of our inner being, how we feel on the inside, some deep way. How are you really? You might feel cold, you might feel irritated by something, but someone asks you, how do you feel really? And then you look deeper beyond the irritation or beyond the cold and say, well, I actually feel pretty satisfied, or I feel content mostly, or I feel happy to be here, even though for the moment I feel cold or irritated or something. So how do you really feel? And so the second category is called the feeling tones that are not connected to how the external world is stimulating our senses. And if you go along with my idea of this external world, when we think ideas and they're pleasant, that's still, in this schema, considered external world. The pleasure of thinking or the horror of thinking, that's just still being stimulated kind of from the outside. What the Buddha has been talking about, the second category, is something that is from the wellsprings within, that bubbles up from within, that doesn't come from the outside. And to begin feeling a sense of wellness, a sense of deep satisfaction. I myself really like the expression at homeness, being a feeling, when you really feel at home, where does that feeling come from? You know, it's like my grandmother back in Norway, in this little bedroom I slept in, there was all wood paneling and wood bed, and back then everything was wood, there was no plastic, and and this big down comforter and this beautiful light coming shining into the bedroom in the morning when I was waking up, and I would just lay under my comforter and I'd read Donald Duck magazines, and that was okay. But then my grandmother would come in with a tray of toast with cheese on it. And I didn't know it at the time. This is also, I only realized when I was an adult, that was a formative experience for me. I was being loved and I didn't know it. My mind didn't know it. I just took it for granted. But something inside was nourished by that. So this idea of at-homeness and feeling, ah, yes. And it wasn't because the toast was good. It was because my grandmother was good, because I was safe. It was like light. It was peaceful. It was all this goodness. And the goodness was this deep feeling inside. And that deep feeling was something that I kind of rediscovered when I started meditating. I started, I know this. This is my grandmother bringing me toast. And so there's this kind of like sometimes a rediscovery as we practice of things we've long lost touch with as life's gotten complicated, that sometimes we tapped into when we're young. And it doesn't have to be like a bit, you know, like dramatic. I mean, toast and in bed is, I don't know, maybe it's dramatic, but I had another one, which was when I was, I guess I was 5 or something. And I would take a white sheet, like a bed sheet, and I'd put it all over our, what seemed to me like a big kitchen table. Couldn't have been that big. And it would drape over the sides. And at a certain time of day when the sun came in, I would go underneath the table and then all this beautiful light would go through the white sheet. And I just felt like so happy and so safe and so peaceful, like everything was good in the world. At some point when I was meditating, I had that under the table feeling. I had this once before, or a few times before. And so these kinds of feelings, I'm trying to evoke or suggest something here, that these are very different qualitative feelings than the feelings of that are dependent on getting the right food or the right drink or the right sensual pleasure or the right, you know, the world has to be just right. It's something that kind of lives and is awoken inside. So the Buddha says at some point in this feeling tone, become aware of this deeper area of feeling tone, what's pleasant and unpleasant. It's easy to overlook it because we have all our kind of concerns with what's going on in the world and the relationship we have with people and jobs we have to work and relationships and all this stuff that kind of keeps us a little bit more at this other level. And sometimes we don't even recognize the importance of being quiet enough to feel something deeper. How really are we deep down? And sometimes what we discover is it's difficult in there. There's fear and there's sorrow and grief and there's not grandmother's toast, but there is the ways that we've been hurt. And so, but as we come into this practice of holding it all in the body and being present, we're learning the art of creating that safety for what's difficult to be there. The art or the skill or the care to just feel it instead of fixing it. Instead of trying to fix the world around us, get everything lined up in the world so we can feel okay. It's no longer about the world when we do this practice. It's no longer about what's outside. While we're doing the practice. While we're doing the practice, it's all about here. And we're at this journey inward. So then the fourth step of this, third step of it in the four areas, is usually translated as the mind states. And it's here that we also find some fascinating things. It says, it talks about first becoming aware of when your state of mind has greed, when it has strong desires, and be aware when it has strong aversions, hostility, and be aware when it has delusion. So a greedy mind state, a aversive mind state, and a deluded mind state. But the instructions are kind of like subtle. It says, be aware of a mind state that is with greed. That is a mind state with aversion, with delusion. And this word with suggests that it's not inherent in the mind that there's greed, hatred, or delusion. It's not essential part of the mind. And when you say with, it means that part of you, the mindfulness, can see that there's greed or hatred or delusion, can see it. But because the mindfulness can see it, it's not your entire mind. It's only a part of the mind. And so you see, oh, there it is. Part of the mind is that way. It's with that. But the mind is more than that. And I think that's begins a kind of process of liberation, not being locked in or not being fully defined by the difficult states of mind. Oh, now that I'm mindful of it, the mindfulness is not that. The mindfulness has some clarity or has some healthy distance or has some independence. Just to know is free of the greed. Just to know is free of the hatred. Just to know is free of the delusion. And I know that because my mindfulness knows that I'm deluded. And in that degree, you're not deluded. Isn't that great? So then it goes deeper. As this crack happens in the mind, where we don't identify with everything in the mind, every thought, every feeling, and don't define ourselves by it, there starts being a space in the mind. And the awareness starts becoming, can relax and not be locked on to thoughts and feelings and everything. And as we settle, there is experience that is sometimes called big mind. In Mahachitta, or a large mind, or expanded mind. A feeling that the consciousness or the awareness is maybe some people describe it as a field, that it's very broad, or that awareness somehow has become coterminous with awareness, with space. It's like it's no longer narrow or tight, or it's now there's a kind of a field of awareness. The mind feels big, and the mind feels big enough to hold everything within it. When it's really large, no matter what happens, there's space in it. So now we've gone from the body, come in closer to the feeling tones, and not just the feeling tones, but the deeper ones, the kind of how are you, you know, in the depth of your being, how's your heart these days? And then as we go into that and see that, there's a way in which awareness, consciousness, starts becoming set free and becomes open more and relaxed, receptive, not defined by what's... We don't define ourselves so much by the details of our life. If anything, we start defining ourselves by the open awareness, the open receptivity, the clarity. But that's not the point, is to have those, but rather... This provides us with a vantage point, degree to which we have some subtleness in the mind, some openness, some peacefulness, some calm. It gives us a vantage point from which to see when the mind, or in the mind, deep inside, maybe some of the deepest places inside, where we're clinging, or we're releasing clinging. We start seeing the mechanism in the mind of attachment and the freedom from attachment. And this is one of the important ways of learning this Dharma practice, is to start being still enough, quiet enough, interested enough, and feel enough safety and support and confidence that you can matter-of-factly, without any judgment and criticism and disappointment, distress, begin noticing little movements of clinging and letting go of clinging. And in one, there's a number of exercises for this area of the practice, but one of them has to do with noticing the knots, K-N-O-T-S. And they usually translate it as fetter in the translations, but it literally means a knot, like a rope that's knotted up. And it's to notice how we get knotted up in things. And then specifically it says that when you see an object, there can be the object and there's you seeing it, and kind of between the two of them, you can get all knotted up. There's a knot. That's the attachment. That's the clinging, the grasping. So if I go into a new meditation hall, some other Dharma center, and I see a striker, bell striker, that's so much better than when we have at IRC. Oh, that's the one I want. And I start thinking only about, how can I get it? Can I? I'm not supposed to steal, so can I buy it? Can I exchange it? Can I beg for it? If I do that, I'm knotted up in their bell striker. If I hear a sound, and I really dislike the sound, my roommate is snoring, and I'm spending half the night being angry at my roommate, writing letters to the president of IRC about you have to not have roommates who snore, you have to screen for them like you do for COVID, and you know, I'm knotted up in that sound. My teacher in Burma, Upandita, famous teacher, his opening to this practice of mindfulness, the way that it really opened up for him, it became really meaningful, was he was a tough, like, he was like a tough guy, like a, I don't know what to say, like the fighter kind of person maybe. And if he raised his eyebrow, you would, like, people would cower. He was like, he had this presence. And so when he was a young monk and was going to start his meditation practice, he was going to sit and meditate up, stay up late at night and get up early and really go all out. But he had a roommate. And his roommate went to bed early and snored. And he would be sitting there in his bed trying to meditate late. And he was indignant. This monk is lazy, he's going to bed early, he's snoring and disturbing my meditation. And that lasted for some nights. And then at some point he decided that he would take the snoring as the object of his mindfulness. And he got concentrated. And that was where the mindfulness opened up for him. So until then, he was knotted up in it. And he freed himself from the knots. And then it became actually beneficial for him to pay attention to this snoring. So in all the senses we have, whether it's, you know, smell or hearing or taste or touch, and this the sensing, the way that we can sense and experience things in the mind, that's probably where most of the knots are. We have a thought and we somehow knot it up in it. We want it or we don't want it, and there's a little knot, there's an attachment, there's a grasping. I like to think of it as wind drag. That as soon as you have a knot, you knotted something, you've slowed down. You can't really, you're not fluid anymore going through. You've created resistance. The more knots you have, the more resistance you have to awareness, the more resistance you have to this fluidity and ease of being in the world. And so we... So going from the body, being embodied, being embodied enough to start feeling what's here. Feeling what's here in a relaxed, open, receptive way. And then start noticing the quality of the mind. Is the mind, is there space in the mind? Is there space in the mind so you don't identify and lock onto everything, but there's kind of like room for things to be there? I think of mindfulness practice as giving breathing room to our experience. Just, there's a room. And then this wonderful feeling of roominess that we have, or the larger mind that develops. And if it can develop in this quality, when we give ourselves the gift of trusting ourselves, trusting the practice, of willing to be here for ourselves, to start attuning ourselves, if it's available, attuning ourselves to the place of goodness within, the place of wellness within. Not attuning ourselves to our neurotic thoughts. Not attuning ourselves to the thoughts that are born from our clingings and our grasping. Attuning ourselves to something settled and peaceful and that's not resisting or confronting or that's, you know, someone just brought you toast. And then from there, it becomes a little bit more intuitive or natural to just notice that when we lose that, when that gets diminished by the wind drag, by the clinging, by the grasping, by the contracting, by the locking onto things, by getting caught up in our thoughts and our concerns. And when we do, we are becoming unsafe for ourselves. As soon as we start clinging, we are hurting ourselves. It might not feel that way in ordinary states of consciousness, but in these deeper states, when we're really settled in here, we can feel the loss that happens. Oh, things have gotten narrower, smaller, darker. They're a little more, there's a little bit, or very much so, more stressful. Oh, there's a little stress I added here. And even though those thoughts are so compelling and seem so important, now I can feel the cost of having those thoughts. To be involved in those thoughts is really expensive. In fact, it kind of hurts. And if we have the same thoughts, some of those kinds of thoughts, hurtful thoughts, repeatedly, over and over and over again, drop by drop, the water jug is filled. Drop by drop, the bathtub is filled. And if it's filled with pain, with ouches, it grows and grows, the pain. But drop by drop, the simple goodness of awareness, simple awareness. The way that Andrea spoke this morning, just become very simple. The simplicity that can see much more. Drop by drop of that simplicity does something very good for ourselves. And we've been learning not to cling so much. And we begin learning slowly the art of releasing the grip. And maybe we can't do it all at once, but we slowly begin to kind of loosen and loosen and loosen. And then we find ourselves holding our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our concerns, our life, and how we think of the life of others, in the equivalent of this open, the open palms of our hand. And if what we're holding is a bird, then we've given the freedom for the bird to fly away. And if it's a bird that's gotten to like you, it'll come back. The woman who lived across the street, the house next door, before, you know, she sold it to us. She used to hold her hand out, and the birds would come and land. Well, I watched it. The birds would land on her hand to eat the seeds she had for them. It was kind of beautiful to watch. That she was friends with the birds, I guess, or something with the birds. They trusted her enough. So they'd land and be there, and then they'd fly away. That's a nice way of living as a human being, to live with non-clinging, and then trust that things can go away, and if it's appropriate, if they're supposed to come back, they'll come back, and if not, well, it's unfortunate if they don't come back, but it's even more unfortunate to clench the hand again. Because if you lost something in the world that doesn't come back, the bird doesn't come back, it's sad enough, maybe. But if you clench the fist, you actually lose a lot more. That's where the real loss is, because now we're losing this wonderful potential we have of coming home to ourselves, being settled and peaceful and cozy and at peace in this world with ourselves. Because we harm ourselves when we cling. So, to not cling to anything in the world. Just before that in the refrain, it talks about not being dependent, to be without dependence. The translations often say independent, which works very well in the United States, because we're like the independence people. You know, it can be interpreted a little bit too self-centeredly to be independent, like them free. But what actually, the word in Pali literally means to be without dependence, without relying on something. And the dictionary says the word also means without attachment. And so we have to be a little careful about this word, without dependence. Of course we depend on people in all kinds of ways. We're so interconnected in this modern world that we depend on a tremendous network of people too, for our water and our electricity and our food and work and all kinds of things. So there is a way in which we all depend on each other that can be seen as being quite beautiful in some ways. But what we're learning to do is to discover that our hearts can be at peace, and that peace, that is not dependent on the world being any particular way. And if we're depending on the world to be a particular way, so our hearts can be at peace, we'll never have a lasting peace. It's just simply not possible. You might be lucky with a little bit of extra effort to get this world lined up and behaving just perfectly the way that you need it to be. I give you some credit that you might have that ability. But it's not going to last long. That I know. Before we have to get everyone lined up again, everything organized again. It's constantly shifting and changing. And so if your heart's well-being is dependent on everything being just how you need it, you'll never really have any lasting peace. But if you discover this inner peace that's not dependent, it doesn't mean that you become aloof. It doesn't mean you don't care. It doesn't mean that you're not still connected to people in rich ways. I would like to propose the opposite. You actually become much more richly, more valuably connected to people, because the soft part of your palm is there to feel and sense and experience the world, the equivalent in your heart. When you're clenched up, you don't have the feelings there. And you understand something about where safety is and protection is and refuge is. And so you become a person who can care for offer that safety to something that's profound in other people. So this practice of satipatthana, this practice of mindfulness awareness, I see it as inseparable, inseparable from caring and benefiting the world around us. So discovering this non-dependence doesn't mean we don't care. But we're not dependent. Our well-being doesn't depend on how things are around us. This is a difficult thing to come to. And I'm not saying this is easy just because I say it in 55 minutes, but, you know, it's easy to do. It's a journey. It's a maturation process. It's something we're steadily, like, practicing moment by moment, minute by minute, slowly, slowly. This is opening and we're learning what this is. We're learning how to live in this world peacefully. We're learning how to make room for ourselves and allow experiences to be free of our attachments, to allow our friends and family be free of our dependence on them, so that then we can care for them more, or have more care for them. It depends what they want our care. So to practice and cultivate this sense of safety and protection that protects self and protects others is one of the great things to do in this life. And you're here on this retreat. And you're here with what you came with, which is your capacity, your faculty for being aware. A simple faculty. And even though the talk maybe is complicated with all these steps, the practice is so simple. Trust your faculty to be aware. But not in the abstract, like, oh yeah, it's a good thing to trust. But continuously, live close to it, that trust. Live close to the awareness, trusting the awareness, so the awareness can receive and sense and feel and really take you into this depth of who you are. Where you're in a way that you're receptive, you have space for it, you're open to it, you're curious about it, interested. And in the end, maybe it turns out that it's not such a big deal after all. Turns out it's just cheese on toast. And it turns out that was pretty profound. It's in the simplicity, maybe the simple things, that we might find some of the greatest possibilities of well-being. So may you continue here on this practice. May you trust yourself and trust your process of awareness. And I'm very happy that we get to do this together. Thank you.